From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this Memorial Day edition of Fresh Air, we remember the soldiers who fought in World War II and a journalist who died telling their stories. Ernie Pyle is considered the greatest World War II correspondent and perhaps the best war reporter in history. His dispatches followed the fighting from North Africa to Italy, Normandy, and finally Okinawa, where he was killed 3 weeks before the war in Europe ended. We'll hear from James Tobin, author of Ernie Pyle's War. It won a National Book Critics Circle Award after it was first published in 1997. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the language of the Vietnam War and how it's being used today. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush placed a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns in Arlington National Cemetery today. Earlier, Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry marked Memorial Day with a visit to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The day's observances took on added significance with the ongoing war in Iraq and a presidential campaign dominated by national security issues. Massachusetts Senator Kerry walked along the dark granite wall of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial to pay tribute to the almost 60,000 men and women who died in that war. Later, President Bush joined veterans and other dignitaries at Arlington National Cemetery.
Today, as we reflect on the men and women who have died in the defense of America, all of us count it a privilege to be citizens of the country they serve.
The president said the world is safer because of those who lost their lives fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. Kerry says the president's policies have made the country less safe. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
In Iraq, two American soldiers have been killed in clashes with Shiite gunmen loyal to radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett says Americans were ambushed in two places in Kufa.
They were just conducting reconnaissance at these two locations, and at each of those, an American soldier was killed at them. And on this Memorial Day, we grieve for their loss, and we grieve for their families that are just getting that news now that their sons will not be coming back from this country because they were conducting those operations.
Kimmett says two other American soldiers were killed over the weekend. A car bomb exploded today near the headquarters of the U.S.-led occupation, killing four people and injuring more than two dozen others. Violent weather over the weekend is being blamed for dozens of injuries and the deaths of at least seven people in the Midwest. There are preliminary accounts of nearly 90 tornadoes touching down. One of the hardest-hit states was Indiana. Chad Bouchard reports from member station WFIU in Bloomington.
A band of severe storms swept across Indiana Sunday, producing tornadoes that touched down in several cities and towns. High winds in Indianapolis tore the roof off a nursing home with 50 residents inside. No one was seriously injured, and residents were evacuated to a nearby hospital. The southern Indiana town of Marengo was decimated when a storm destroyed more than four dozen homes and left an elderly man dead in his collapsed mobile home. The same storm system affected several states from Oklahoma to West Virginia over the weekend, causing two fatal car accidents in Kansas and three tornado-related deaths in Missouri. In West Virginia, at least three counties are in a state of emergency. Indiana Governor Joe Kernan has declared the Hoosier State to be a disaster area. For NPR News in Bloomington, I'm Chad Bouchard.
In Washington, this is NPR News. Saudi officials said today that they're fully in control of oil facilities near Khobar after militants attacked a foreign workers' compound over the weekend and left 19 hostages dead. The dead included an American, a British citizen, an Italian, and eight Indians. The Saudi Interior Ministry said 25 people were injured. A statement on the Internet claimed responsibility for the attack on behalf of al-Qaeda and said that this year would be a deadly one in Saudi Arabia. At least 15 people have been killed by a bomb that exploded in a mosque in Pakistan. It happened during evening prayers in the southern city of Karachi. NPR's Philip Reeves reports from New Delhi.
It happened at a Shiite mosque a day after a leading Sunni cleric was shot dead in the same city. Karachi's long been plagued by sectarian violence and the speculation that this attack was an act of revenge. Sunday's killing of the cleric, Mufti Nizamuddin Shamsai, ignited trouble on the streets, and so did the bombing. Police used tear gas to disperse angry Muslim men. Reports said they ransacked and burnt several buildings and set fire to cars. This attack came despite heightened security measures in the southern port city after the killing of the cleric. Just over 3 weeks ago, around 20 people were killed in a bombing, which also intensified the tensions between Sunni and Shia Muslims in Pakistan. Philip Reeves, NPR News, New Delhi.
Firefighters in New Mexico say they've managed to contain about 35% of a wildfire in the Lincoln National Forest. They say nearly 700 workers have cleared a line around the fire, which has burned more than 30,000 acres since it was first reported on May 15th. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop features NPR Cooks, a collection of recipes and the stories behind them from the folks who bring you NPR. Available now at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Memorial Day, we remember the soldiers who fought in World War II and a journalist who died telling their stories. Ernie Pyle is widely acknowledged as the finest World War II correspondent and perhaps the best war correspondent in history. He was killed in combat in the Pacific shortly before the Allied victory in Europe. James Tobin is the author of the book Ernie Pyle's War. Tobin writes, "Pyle was America's eyewitness to the 20th century's supreme ordeal. His published version of World War II had become the nation's version. America's mental picture of the soldiers who had won it was largely Pyle's creation. He and his grimy GIs, frightened but enduring, had become the heroic symbols of what the soldiers and their children would remember as the good war." The biography, Ernie Pyle's War, won a National Book Critics Circle Award after it was first published in 1997. I asked James Tobin to start by reading one of the Ernie Pyle columns excerpted in the biography.
This is Ernie Pyle writing in a column from Tunisia in early 1943. "The men are walking. They don't slouch. It is the terrible deliberation of each step that spells out their appalling tiredness. Their faces are black and unshaven. They are young men, but the grime and whiskers and exhaustion make them look middle-aged. In their eyes as they pass is not hatred, not excitement, not despair, not the tonic of their victory. There is just the simple expression of being here as though they had been here, doing this forever and nothing else. The line moves on, but it never ends. All afternoon, men keep coming round the hill and vanishing eventually over the horizon. It is one long, tired line of ant-like men. There is an agony in your heart, and you feel almost ashamed to look at them. They are just guys from Broadway and Main Street, but you wouldn't remember them. They are too far away now. They are too tired. Their world can never be known to you."
That's a chilling last sentence. Their world can never be known to you. How much did Pyle try to describe the more horrible aspects of that war? How much did he want to share that with the readers, and what did he want to protect them from?
I think he wanted to share as much of it as he thought the public could tolerate, as much as sort of was within the bounds of good taste as it was defined in the 1940s. He wanted to communicate the reality of war, and to a certain extent described certainly death, terrible injuries, battle fatigue, but sometimes when he tried to describe the gorier details, his content would be censored. There was a certain reticence on the part of the military and on the part of the war correspondents about describing too much of the really worst realities of war. In a certain sense, too, Ernie is saying here, as he said often, not just that I don't want to describe the realities to you, but there is a fundamental difficulty in telling someone who hasn't been through war what war is really like.
What was the style of Ernie Pyle's war reporting? What was different about his reporting than the other correspondents of World War II?
Ernie wrote in the first person, for one thing. Ernie's writing came in a column. He was not a person writing news dispatches about, you know, the previous day's battles, about how the war was going in a military sense, at least not very often. So he had time to hang out with soldiers, to live with units for sometimes for days and even weeks at a time, and to reflect on what he had seen and to write about it more carefully than the average sort of daily newspaper correspondent had time to write. His style was simple declarative sentences. What came through was a tremendously sensitive, compassionate sensibility. I think that more than anything else, along with his basic genius as a prose stylist, is what made people respond to him so broadly and so in such a heartfelt way during the war.
You say that he created a new kind of war hero. What do you mean?
Well, before World War II, the kind of classic image of the soldier, of the war hero in America, is probably captured best by Theodore Roosevelt in the charge up San Juan Hill during the Spanish-American War. It's sort of a Victorian image of heroism, of heroic advance against the foe. In Ernie's writings, what we see is a different kind of heroism. It's a heroism of endurance. It's a very different kind of war, obviously. This is industrial warfare, where what most soldiers are doing in battle most of the time is gutting it out, is just surviving against sort of terrible onslaughts of artillery, especially. And so that's what kind of comes through in Ernie's corpus, is the image of a suffering soldier who is enduring against, you know, terrific odds. And so that's really a new kind of admirable quality that he holds up to the American public.
I'd like you to read an excerpt of a column in which he just described what was probably the first war death that he witnessed. Maybe you can give us the context of this column and read an excerpt for us.
This is shortly after Ernie had arrived in North Africa, which is really his first involvement in the American part of the war, late 1942, early 1943. And Ernie had covered aviation before, so he was comfortable with pilots and flyers and flight mechanics. And so one of the first things that he does is go with an Air Corps outfit and hang out at this airfield in Algeria. And so he's describing this scene, and I'll read just a little scene setter and then jump to the some words of his. It was late afternoon at our desert aerodrome. The sun was lazy, the air was warm, and a faint haze of propeller dust hung over the field, giving it softness. We had already seen death that afternoon, for one of the returning fortresses had released a red flare over the field, and I had stood with others beneath the great plane as they handed its dead pilot head downward through the escape hatch onto a stretcher. The faces of his crew were grave, and nobody talked very much. One man clutched a leather cap with blood on it. The pilot's hands were very white. Everybody knew the pilot. He was so young a couple of hours ago. The war came inside us then, and we felt it deeply. Then Ernie describes a group of flying fortresses that had been out on a mission and were coming back. Most of them had made it back to the field. One was still missing. And they wait, really, for several hours, and they give up the plane for lost. And then all of a sudden there's a flare seen on the horizon, and they realize that it's that last fortress coming back to the field, but very slowly. He says, "It seemed almost on the ground, it was so low, and in the first glance we could sense that it was barely moving, barely staying in the air. Crippled and alone, 2 hours behind all the rest, it was dragging itself home. I am a layman and no longer of the fraternity that flies, but I can feel. And at that moment, I felt something close to human love for that faithful, battered machine, that far, dark speck struggling toward us with such pathetic slowness. Thousands of men around that vast field suddenly realized that they were weak and that they could hear their hearts pounding. Our 10 dead men were miraculously back from the grave."
One of the great things about Ernie Pyle's war writing is that it's almost like he's writing letters home to all of America. He's writing in the first person. He's addressing the readers very directly. It's personal in a way that I think is very uncommon for newspaper writing of that period.
That's right. And in fact, Ernie described himself as a letter writer. Even before the war, he said, "That's essentially what I do, is write letters to people." He had developed this style as a traveling columnist before the war, spent 6 years traveling around the country and the whole Western Hemisphere, writing very much in the style that he used during the war. So it was a comfortable it was a comfortable way of writing for him. And really, the column that we read during the war is one that he'd been already writing for several years.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with James Tobin about his biography of Ernie Pyle, the famous World War II correspondent. His biography is called Ernie Pyle's War, America's Eyewitness to World War II. How did it work with Ernie Pyle in the military? How did he hook up with the troops that he traveled with? Did he have to get permission from anyone on top before doing it?
Well, you would apply to be a war correspondent, and you would be accredited to one theater or another. Ernie pretty quickly established himself as one of the leading reporters, and pretty soon as very much the leader. And so, the generals, the military bureaucrats were delighted to have Ernie come with whatever unit he chose to come with. They knew it was great publicity for their outfit. But he would often have a jeep to himself or would travel with a colleague, and really, especially in North Africa early in the war, would really roam around at will. Now, all dispatches from all correspondents were censored, passed through military censors before they were transmitted back to the United States. But after a while, I think it was in most cases very clear to the correspondents what was permissible and what wasn't. Everybody knew the rules. And most of the censorship rules applied simply to military security, as they do now.
This was before satellite phones. How did Ernie Pyle get his columns back to his newspaper?
Mostly by teletype. If he was in Europe, say, if he was in France near the end of the war and the campaign in Normandy, he would go to a press camp, and the dispatch would be, after being censored, it would be sent by teletype to London, and then by transatlantic cable back to New York. So it went through several steps. There were more filters than there are now, for sure.
Ernie Pyle was a columnist, not a news reporter. So, you know, people might wonder, well, how did someone like Ernie Pyle cover an event like D-Day, just like a massive battle like D-Day? And so I thought I'd ask you to read an excerpt of Ernie Pyle's column about D-Day, what he chose to say about that event.
You bet. Ernie came in the day after D-Day, and he's faced with the battle being sort of a mile or so inland. He doesn't want to write about that. He wants to try and capture what had happened on the beach on June 6th. And so, what I think is just a brilliant piece of journalistic strategy, he just takes a walk on the beach, walks along, describing what he sees at his feet. And at first, he describes some of the materiel and the office junk that's there and all kinds of things that are on material things that are on the beach. Then he writes, "But there is another and more human litter. It extends in a thin little line, just like a high water mark, for miles along the beach. This is the strewn personal gear that will never be needed again, of those who fought and died to give us our entrance into Europe. Here in a jumbled row, for mile on mile, are soldiers' packs. Here are socks and shoe polish, sewing kits, diaries, Bibles, and hand grenades. Here are the latest letters from home, with the address on each one neatly razored out, one of the security precautions enforced before the boys embarked. Here are toothbrushes and razors and snapshots of families back home staring up at you from the sand. Here are pocketbooks, metal mirrors, extra trousers, and bloody abandoned shoes. Here are broken-handled shovels and portable radios smashed almost beyond recognition. I picked up a pocket Bible with a soldier's name in it and put it in my jacket. I carried it half a mile or so and then put it back down on the beach. I don't know why I picked it up or why I put it back down. I stepped over the form of one youngster whom I thought dead. But when I looked down, I saw he was only sleeping. He was very young and very tired. He lay on one elbow, his hand suspended in the air about 6 inches from the ground, and in the palm of his hand he held a large, smooth rock. I stood and looked at him a long time. He seemed in his sleep to hold that rock lovingly, as though it were his last link with a vanishing world."
My guest is James Tobin, author of Ernie Pyle's War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is James Tobin, and we're talking about his biography of the World War II correspondent Ernie Pyle. I'm always interested in what draws a journalist into war reporting, into risking their life to cover a war. Let's talk about why Ernie Pyle did it. Let's start, first of all, with his childhood. He grew up on a farm, and he wanted out. He wanted an adventurous life, and he knew he wasn't going to have it on the farm. He enlisted in the Army at the end of World War I, but I guess he never... The war ended before he got to see combat.
That's it.
So what kind of adventure, what kind of life did he seek out after the end of World War I, when he got out of the military?
Well, Ernie loved to travel and wanted to see the world, and so found that newspapering offered him probably the best chance of doing that. And quickly made lots of trips, traveled to Asia, traveled to South America, and wound up in Washington and New York as a newspaper writer. He got bogged down in a desk job for a number of years, was managing editor of a now defunct paper called the Washington Daily News, and proposed that he, to his editors, that he be allowed to just go out on the road and write. There were very few reporters who really were roving reporters, genuinely traveling all the time, but Ernie became one, and in 1935 started this amazing just journey across the country, back and forth, went to every state, went to Alaska, went to Hawaii, went to South America and Central America, and wrote a column that appeared 6 days a week. It's an astonishing amount of work.
And let's talk a little bit about his personal life. He had a troubled marriage. What were some of the problems within the marriage?
Ernie was married to a very bright and interesting woman, Geraldine Siebolds, whom he called Jerry. But it was pretty clear not long after they were married in the 20s that she was deeply troubled, came from a troubled family. She became an alcoholic and a drug abuser and was probably manic depressive. And so he tried over the years in many different ways to try and snap her out of it, to get her into some kind of therapy. He thought that the travel column would be a way of changing, providing a constant change of scene for her. He thought that might help her. But none of it did help her. And so by the time of Pearl Harbor, they were their marriage was really shattered. Ernie was starting to have extramarital affairs, and decided early in 1942 that they had to split up, and he hoped that maybe by splitting up, it would shock Jerry into sort of a new self-awareness, that she might seek more effective treatment, and that they might be able to remarry, which ultimately did happen. But it's really to escape that real personal trauma and his own depression that Ernie went to war in the beginning. It wasn't so much that he was dying to cover the war, it was that he was dying to just get out of his situation and find a change to escape. And I think that, I don't know how many reporters in Iraq would say something like that, but certainly through the history of war correspondence, there is a tradition of reporters singing war as a way to get out, as a way of sort of personal, to find personal escape and liberation.
You said that Ernie Pyle had depression problems himself. Why did he think that being in the front lines with the soldiers would help him get over his depression?
Well, I don't know if he thought of it in such a one-to-one relationship, but I think he realized once he was in the middle of the war that warfare was profoundly distracting, that it was a way of allowing yourself to be absorbed into something much larger than yourself. That's not to say that he was a warmonger, or that he was desperate to see gory scenes. It's that he was fascinated by the spectacle of it. And I think to some extent it did lift him out of his depression.
Well, he writes about how he found war strangely liberating. Would you read an excerpt of that?
Yes. After going overseas, Ernie spent a number of months in Ireland and England, and then he was able to go along with Operation Torch, the American, the Allied invasion of North Africa. And so he goes really without a clear sense of how long he's going to stay there. He's not really committing himself to being a war correspondent. But as the American forces go into battle and he goes along, he does find himself feeling like he's making a contribution, feeling like the copy that he's writing is good and valuable. And so he was really taken by the whole thing. And part of what he was taken by was just the sort of rugged, outdoor, difficult life that he was in. And he says this about that. "The danger comes in spurts. Discomfort is perpetual. Dirt and cold are almost constant. Outside of food and cigarettes, there are none of the little things that make life normal back home. There are no chairs, lights, floors, or tables. There isn't any place to set anything, or any store to buy things. There are no newspapers, milk, beds, sheets, radiators, beer, ice cream, or hot water. A man just sort of exists, either standing up working or lying down sleeping. There is no pleasant in between. The velvet is all gone from living." But as I say, Pyle also finds this life really exhilarating and liberating. He says, "You don't have appointments to keep. Nobody cares how you look. Red tape is at a minimum. You have no desk, no designated hours. You don't wash your hands before you eat, nor afterwards either. It would be a heaven for small boys with dirty ears."
James Tobin is the author of the book Ernie Pyle's War. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble. Now featuring My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience by Juan Williams. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. By the Sundance Channel, premiering the weekly original series Anatomy of a Scene with the making of The Door in the Floor starring Jeff Bridges and Kim Basinger, tomorrow night at 9. And from Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime by Mark Haddon. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the public versus the private Ernie Pyle. We continue our conversation with his biographer, James Tobin. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the words and expressions that came out of the Vietnam War and how they're being used today.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with James Tobin. We're talking about his 1997 book, Ernie Pyle's War, a biography of the famous World War II newspaper correspondent. When we left off, we were talking about Pyle's depressions. Tobin says covering the war initially helped liberate Pyle from depression, but that sense of liberation didn't last long.
Well, I think that it helped Ernie feel better for a while. And then as he saw more and more of the war itself became the most depressing thing in his life. I think this is, not that I've ever been in the middle of combat or anywhere close to it, but in reading a lot about the experience of war, you find soldiers and reporters saying that after a period of exhilaration and fascination, the more you're exposed to it, the more you become debilitated psychologically and emotionally. And I think that this is what happens to Ernie. As the war goes on, as he goes from North Africa to the campaign in Sicily, which was very difficult, the summer of 1943, and then especially to the Italian campaign, which was even worse the following winter, and then to France, he sees more and more death. He himself is exposed to more and more danger, has a couple of very narrow, close calls, almost dies. And nobody can do that and stay stable. You can't stay in combat, modern combat, for a long period of time and be okay. It causes deep suffering in anybody who is exposed to it long enough.
He writes a little bit about the depression and the suffering he was going through covering the war. And he writes about this not in a column, but in a letter to a friend. And the letter I'm thinking of is something that he wrote after losing a friend in the war.
Early in February 1944, a reporter named Raymond Clapper was killed. He was one of these prominent newspaper columnists and had been a colleague of Ernie's in Scripps Howard. Was mostly known as a Washington correspondent, but went to war and was killed in the South Pacific, and Ernie found out about it. And he writes to his close friend and his editor, Lee Miller. He says, "I'm just floored by it. What a waste of intelligence and character. As the whole war is, it gives me the creeps. The whole thing is getting pretty badly under my skin, Lee. I've got so I brood about it, about the whole thing, I mean. And I have a personal reluctance to die that is always in my mind like a weight. Instead of growing stronger and hard, as good veterans do, I've become weaker and more frightened. I'm all right when I'm actually at the front, but it's when I pull back and start thinking and visualizing that it almost overwhelms me. I've even got so I don't sleep well, and have half-awake, hideous dreams about the war."
Is that the kind of sentiment you think he would have confessed to his readers, or does he save those kinds of the vulnerabilities and the doubts and the overwhelming despair that he's feeling? Does he save that for letters, for personal letters?
He expressed that more often in letters, but he does express it in his column. There are comparable passages in a number of the columns. I think what he does is ration that sort of feeling and that sort of expression. There was a feeling during the war, and I think that this is pretty true in any democratic society fighting a war. There's a line that correspondents feel they have to walk between realism and encouraging a kind of demoralization among their readers. They worry, as Ernie said in a couple of these passages, that people just won't understand it. And I think that this is the reason that many soldiers, after they come home, are reluctant to say what really happened, even to their loved ones. I think a lot of us have found that our fathers and grandfathers who fought in World War II have taken most of their lives to be able to really say what it was like. And it's only near the end when they want to tell people, this was what I went through. When they're younger, it's really difficult to bridge the gap between the front and the home front.
You write how there was a growing difference between the public Ernie Pyle, the people the public knew through his newspaper columns, and the private Ernie Pyle. What was the difference?
Well, it's certainly true that Ernie had established a kind of persona in the column that was, you know, universally known and loved. And the persona was of a kind of hapless, carefree, kind of Charlie Chaplin-esque figure. Funny, casual, able to kind of bounce from one thing to another without being terribly troubled. And that was very much not what Ernie was experiencing as the war went on. And so there is a kind of divide between the sort of reassuring, comforting persona of the column, who is telling people, you know, it's bad, but your sons, your brothers, your husbands, they're getting through it okay. They'll be all right. They haven't changed deeply. He wants to reassure on that score. And yet, as you said in his letters, you do see a darker side emerging, where he's not so sure about the suffering that he's seeing around. There's one column where he says, I couldn't find the four freedoms among the dead men. That's about the toughest he ever expressed it in an actual column. More often he's saying that sort of thing in letters. And so he does sort of unburden himself to his wife, to his editor, and to close friends.
Ernie Pyle was also known through his portrayal by Burgess Meredith in the movie The Story of G.I. Joe, a World War II film that was made while the war was still going on. And what was the involvement of the military in this movie?
Well, the movie was really the military's idea. And this is an interesting side of the sort of the movie history of World War II that we all know, that I certainly didn't know until I did the research for the book. Early in the war, it was the Navy and the Air Corps that most movies were made about. Those were seen to be the heroic branches of the armed services, and the glamorous ones and the exciting ones. That's where the real action was. Whereas the infantry was, seen as dull and dirty and slogging and not of, not the sort of thing you would make a movie about. So there were figures in the army in Washington who were looking for a producer who would make a movie about the army, and they came across this young producer, Lester Cowan, whom they convinced to look into this. Cowan actually talked to this fellow, Raymond Clapper, who said, well, if you want to make a movie about the infantry, you should read the columns of Ernie Pyle. And Cowan then went back and read all of Ernie's columns to date and was very much taken by them, and approached Scripps Howard and Ernie and proposed the idea of a movie that would be based on Ernie's work in the field. And so the story of G.I. Joe, which didn't come out ultimately until 1945, is an interesting kind of hybrid. It comes out of this, essentially a propaganda impulse to give the army its due, to give the infantry its due in Hollywood. But then Ernie was so insistent that it be realistic that the army never really got the kind of heroic tale that it wanted, that it envisioned at the beginning anyway. What it got was a strange movie, an interesting movie, without much of a plot, that is really just more documentary in its feel, and that really does present the new kind of Pyle version of the heroic soldier, dirty, slogging, enduring, not the gallant, rushing over the hilltop kind of soldier.
Some of the film is based on one of Ernie Pyle's most famous columns. Robert Mitchum stars in the film as a very sympathetic captain. And the column that the movie is partially based on is about Captain Henry Wasco. Would you read an excerpt of that column for us and tell us what you think makes this column important?
The column is set in Italy. Ernie was in the mountains with army troops, and particularly with a group that is involved in using mules to bring dead bodies off down from the mountains where the fighting had been going on. It was too difficult and steep for soldiers to bring the bodies down themselves, so they used these mules. So he writes in this column in part, I was at the foot of the mule trail the night they brought Captain Wasco down. The moon was nearly full at the time, and you could see far up the trail, and even partway across the valley. Soldiers made shadows as they walked. Dead men had been coming down the mountain all evening, lashed onto the backs of mules. The first one came early in the morning. I don't know who that one was. You feel small in the presence of dead men, and ashamed of being alive. and you don't ask silly questions. Then Pyle explains that several more bodies are brought into this clearing by this cowshed where there are men standing. And one of them is identified as this Captain Wasco. The men in the road seemed reluctant to leave. They stood around, and gradually I could sense them moving, one by one, close to Captain Wasco's body. Not so much to look, I think, as to say something in finality, to him and to themselves. I stood close by, and I could hear. One soldier came and looked down, and he said out loud, "God damn it." That's all he said, and then he walked away. Then another soldier came and bent over, and he too spoke to his dead captain, not in a whisper, but awfully tenderly, and he said, "I sure am sorry, sir." Then the first man squatted down, and he reached down and took the captain's hand, and he sat there for a full 5 minutes, holding the dead hand in his own, and looking intently into the dead face, and he never uttered a sound all the time he sat there. Finally, he put the hand down, he reached up and gently straightened the points of the captain's shirt collar, and then he sort of rearranged the tattered edges of his uniform around the wound. And then he got up and walked away down the road in the moonlight, all alone.
Why do you think that column had the impact that it did?
I think it had an impact chiefly because it's a fine piece of writing. It's extremely descriptive. It really is just a model of what fine documentary journalism ought to be, in just bringing the reader into a scene and seeing something extraordinary. I think the meaning of the column for people, it affected people different ways, but I think that the chief meaning of the column is that it, between the lines, drives home this poignant theme of the comradeship among soldiers. It's not so much about the captain himself, who is hardly described at all in the rest of the column, but it's about the feeling of the men for each other and for the dead man. And so there's this sense of tragedy and loss, but also of, I think there's a certain reassuring theme between the lines of something good coming out of this awful experience of war, that there's a kind of love that exists in war. And that's one of the themes that we see often in fine war writing, that the people will admit to a certain appeal about the experience of war, and that's one of them, is that bond of love among soldiers.
My guest is James Tobin, author of Ernie Pyle's War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Tobin. We're talking about his biography of Ernie Pyle, whose dispatches from World War II gave many Americans their most vivid and lasting descriptions of the war. Ernie Pyle died in the war. How did he die?
Ernie was killed in the Pacific. He went home shortly after the liberation of Paris, late summer of 1944, and spent several months in the U.S. Trying to rest, but really being sort of kind of a public figure, it was difficult, and had more difficult times with his wife, who attempted suicide during that period. And I think he came to feel that he couldn't just stop before the war was over. He had to go back to it. And because he had been in Europe so long, although that was certainly the place he identified with, the people he identified with, he felt that he owed it to the Navy and the Marines in the Pacific to go there. And so that was set up with the Navy. He spent time on an aircraft carrier in the Western Pacific, and then took part in the invasion of Okinawa, and then just in April of 1945, went ashore on a little island that is just off Okinawa called Iwo Jima. And really in just a kind of a, not in the middle of a battle, but in just a random situation, he was crossing the island in a jeep The Jeep was fired upon by a Japanese machine gunner, and Ernie and the other guys jumped out and into a ditch at the side of the road. And when the machine gun was quiet, he raised his head up and was hit in the temple and killed immediately.
Was his body found right away?
His body was recovered only after a few hours. There was still the danger of this machine gun nest, and so finally some guys crawled out, and a photographer took a picture of the body, and some other guys pulled Ernie's body back, and the word already was sent out via radio that Ernie had been killed. And it was an extraordinary event. It was only a few days after President Roosevelt had died, and the headlines about Ernie Pyle's death were almost as large as the headlines about Roosevelt's death.
Now, he had a column that he was in the middle of writing that was discovered in one of his pockets when he died. He was expecting that there would be victory in Europe any day, and so he was already writing the column about that victory. The column was never published, but you published some of that in your biography of Pyle. I'd like you to read it for us.
This was just it hadn't been typed up yet. It was in Ernie's pocket, just in a handwritten draft, you know, with crossouts and arrows, and this is part of what he wrote. "And so it is over. The catastrophe on one side of the world has run its course. The day that had so long seemed would never come has come at last." And he said he's writing this in waters near Japan. "But my heart is still in Europe, for the companionship of 2.5 years of death and misery is a spouse that tolerates no divorce. In the joyousness of high spirits, it is easy for us to forget the dead. There are so many of the living who have burned into their brains forever the unnatural sight of cold dead men scattered over the hillsides and in the ditches along the high rows of hedge throughout the world. Dead men by mass production, in one country after another, month after month and year after year. Dead men in winter and dead men in summer. Dead men in such familiar promiscuity that they become monotonous. Dead men in such monstrous infinity that you come almost to hate them. Those are the things that you at home need not even try to understand. To you at home, they are columns of figures, or a near one who went away and just didn't come back. You didn't see him lying so grotesque and pasty beside the gravel road in France. We saw him by the multiple thousands. That's the difference."
Why do you think Scripps Howard decided not to publish this column that he'd been writing?
I think that gets too close to the way people feel when they've been at war for a long time in the middle of it and have a point of view about it that is simply unacceptable to people who have viewed the war from the home front, from afar. That vision of war is just at odds with the way people at home wanted to feel about the war, which was that it was tragic and that, and of course, many had suffered losses, but not that it was this reality that you couldn't, this dark reality that you just couldn't escape from. And that's what Ernie is talking about. Ernie's talking there about what it really felt like to be at war for a long time. And it was ultimately intolerable.
And he's talking about dead men by mass production.
Right. That's a pretty terrifying image.
James Tobin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
James Tobin is the author of the 1997 biography, Ernie Pyle's War. His latest book is called To Conquer the Air, The Wright Brothers and the Great Race for Flight. Our interview was recorded in April of 2003. Here's a voiceover from the film The Story of G.I. Joe with Burgess Meredith in the role of Ernie Pyle. The words are taken from Pyle's own writings.
"That is our war. And we will carry it with us as we go from one battleground to another until it's all over. We will win. I hope we can rejoice with victory, but humbly. That all together we will try out of the memory of our anguish, to reassemble our broken world into a pattern so firm and so fair that another great war can never again be possible. And for those beneath the wooden crosses, there is nothing we can do except perhaps to pause and murmur, thanks, pal. Thanks.
Burgess Meredith from the story of G.I. Joe. Critics of the war in Iraq have called it another Vietnam. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the language of the Vietnam War and how it's being used today. This is Fresh Air. Some critics of the war in Iraq have called it another Vietnam, a comparison the Bush administration strongly rejects. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been thinking about how the Vietnam experience has permeated our language.
On the day of the ceasefire of the first Iraq war in 1991, President George H.W. Bush wrote in his diary, "Vietnam will soon be behind us." Fat chance. 13 years later, the mother of all battles is a trivial pursuit item, while Vietnam is still raw in the national psyche. Hence the indignant reactions last month when Senator Kennedy charged that Iraq had become George Bush's Vietnam. The president called the analogy false and said it sent the wrong message to our troops and to the enemy. And other administration supporters described it as outrageous, hysterical, or defeatist. The charge set off a flurry of comparing and contrasting. Opponents of the war were toting up the numerous similarities between Vietnam and Iraq. Its supporters noted the significant differences. That's always the way it is with these comparisons. History has no end of lessons to teach us if we could only figure out which of them are going to be on the test. But as the heated reactions to Kennedy's charges made clear, calling Iraq another Vietnam isn't an idle exercise in comparative history. It implies that the war is a colossal mistake brought about by American arrogance and hubris. Vietnam is one of those names that have become common nouns like Waterloo, Pearl Harbor, or Munich, words that have seceded from history and entered the language as the names of object lessons. For example, Munich is just shorthand for an elastic fable about the dangers of giving in to an aggressor. The administration invoked it to describe the French and German refusal to back a preemptive attack on Saddam Hussein. Spiro Agnew invoked it in 1968 when Hubert Humphrey suggested withdrawing some troops from Vietnam. Inevitably, fables like those color the other words that touch them. Before 1938, appeasement could simply mean bringing peace. President Roosevelt used the word approvingly to describe Mussolini's 1936 conquest of Ethiopia. But after Munich, appeasement was reduced to an epithet. Vietnam is a much more complicated narrative than Munich, of course, with many more words attached to it. The administration may insist that Iraq doesn't look like Vietnam, but there's no way to keep the two from sounding alike. Some expressions simply conjure up the setting, in country, the facts on the ground, collateral damage. But others are charged with the bitter lessons of that period, even if people don't always hear them right off. Just a couple of weeks after the Iraq War began, Presidential Press Secretary Ari Fleischer reassured the public that slowly but surely the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people are being won. In retrospect, Fleischer's choice of words was overconfident, if not imprudent. Hearts and minds is saturated with unsettling memories that bubble to the surface as resistance to the occupation swelled. Or take the charges that the administration's critics were failing to support the troops. That association recalled Vietnam, too. In earlier wars, supporting the troops was something you did by collecting scrap or buying war bonds. But by the late 60s or early 70s, the irony of the phrase was becoming apparent as people questioned whether support for the war was in the best interest of the people who were fighting it. I remember in 1971 hearing Tom T. Hall's sardonic song, "Mama Bake a Pie," about a legless vet returning home. If country stations were playing that song, I thought, the administration was on its way to losing the hearts and minds of the American people as well. It isn't surprising that a discussion that begins with phrases like hearts and minds and support the troops should call up the word quagmire as the war drags on, even if the jungle metaphor seems a little out of place for a desert locale. And it's predictable that supporters of the war respond with phrases like stay the course. It's as if everybody's reading from the same yellowing libretto. The other day I was wondering if anybody had used the light at the end of the tunnel in connection with Iraq yet. When I did a Google search, it turned up 15,000 hits. If the language of Vietnam still has a hold on us, it's because the memory of its trauma and divisiveness is still vivid, even if the war itself isn't. By now, a majority of the population has no direct recollection of Vietnam itself. What the name calls to mind isn't the evening news reports from the period, but a pastiche of images from the Green Berets, Coming Home, The Deer Hunter, and Born on the 4th of July. Up to now, the Iraq War hasn't been anywhere near as wrenching a national experience as Vietnam was. It's touched a lot fewer lives and stirred up far less turbulence and dissension. And the war may yet come to a resolution without creating the kind of collective trauma that leaves its marks on the language for generations to come. But if not, Iraq may very well displace Vietnam as a cautionary tale, the same way 9/11 has displaced Pearl Harbor as the name of a devastating surprise attack. The next time we find ourselves contemplating some foreign intervention, people may be warning that it could turn out to be another Iraq. At that point, we really will have put Vietnam behind us, but it's hard to view the prospect as optimistically as the first President Bush did in 1991.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and author of the new book, Going Nuclear. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program today was produced by Roberta Shorrock, who also directed the show. Our engineers are Julian Hertzfeld and Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Beyond Belief by Elaine Pagels, author of The Gnostic Gospels. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, South African satirist Peter Dirkace. He's described himself as a middle-aged, fat, bald, Afrikaner Jewish drag queen from Cape Town. The apartheid regime used to be the target of his humor. Now it's the AIDS epidemic and the way President Thabo Mbeki has dealt with it. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.